From the Sky News Centre at 5. Temperatures are set to plunge again tonight after the coldest night in more than 14 years. Parts of Scotland shivered in minus 22 degrees. That's only marginally warmer than the South Pole. Roads remain treacherous and food supplies in some areas are scarce as communities are cut off by the snow. Gordon Brown says he and his ministers are focused on ensuring energy supplies and getting the country moving.
We're doing everything we can to make sure that there is a proper distribution of and a fair way of grid around the country, and to make sure that people can be sure that where they have to make a journey, that we are properly providing for them.
Dissident Republicans are being blamed for a car bomb attack in Northern Ireland in which a Catholic police officer was critically injured. The 33-year-old's undergoing emergency surgery in hospital after the device exploded under his vehicle in County Antrim. Detective Chief Superintendent Derek Williamson is condemning the attack.
We, of course, remain resolute and determined to face down the cowards and the faceless thugs who committed this atrocious act of terrorism last night. We do, of course, need the help of the community in doing that.
Labour's deputy leader Harriet Harman's managed to keep hold of her licence despite admitting driving without due care and attention. A Camberwell and Peckham MP has been fined £350 plus costs after reversing into a parked car in London last July. She received 3 points on her licence to add to the 6 she's already got. The total number of people in the UK who've died after contracting swine flu has risen to 360. But in the last week, there were fewer than 5,000 new cases of the virus, down from an estimated 9,000 a week in mid-December. In football, Bolton finally have their man as Owen Coyle has been confirmed as their new manager. And former Arsenal captain Patrick Vieira has joined Manchester City on a 6-month deal. And the weather's wiping out this weekend's sporting calendar. In the Premier League, the matches at Burnley, Fulham and Sunderland are off, while Liverpool's match against Tottenham is also postponed. That's the latest. I'm Kat Higgins.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Morning at the Jones House.
Morning, love.
Oh, another day of meetings.
Meanwhile, in the kitchen, younger brother James and Clive the dog head down to get their breakfast.
Phew, something smells down here. There's a horrible smell of gas down here, Mum. Don't flip the switch!
Mrs. Jones calls the National Gas Emergency Service line on 0800 111 999.
Hello, yes, I can smell gas in my house.
Okay, if you can open up your doors and windows to allow some ventilation, please do not switch on or off any electrical appliances. We will have an engineer with you very shortly.
Well done, James. I didn't know about that switch thingy.
We make a good team, don't we, Clive?
Smell gas? Don't risk it. Call free on 0800 111 999.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guest this week to discuss some of the big stories this week in Bristol, Britain and around the world is campaign coordinator at Labour Behind the Label, Anna McMullen. Our regular old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour from 6, Billy Quayne will be along with his credit crunch beating What's On For Free this weekend. If you can afford worst buses monopoly bus fares to get there, that is. Also, after 6, we take a look at the coming Ukrainian presidential election. The biggest country in Europe. Will it choose the Western-backed or Russian-backed candidates? Also, looking back over the past decade, we review the untimely death of Robin Cook. That's in the second hour. We'll be discussing this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, 0 degrees, average daytime temperature, so staying cold. Snow turning up again on Saturday afternoon and possibly through until Sunday morning. So make the most of it on Saturday because it could be very difficult to move around on Sunday. Next week, staying around about 0 degrees, certainly not going above that during most of next week. That's the average daytime temperature. Possible bounce of snow again on Tuesday through until next weekend. That weekend, 15th, 16th of January, again, very cold. Average daytime temperatures below freezing. Possible further snow on Saturday week and possibly dry on Sunday. That's the 15th and 16th of January, weekend after next. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight or so from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news. And joining us live here in the studio this evening is Anna McMullen from Labour Behind the Label. Anna, welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much.
Now, tell us first of all, are you actually from Bristol and what is Labour Behind the Label?
Yes, I'm from Bristol. Well, I'm not originally from Bristol, but I live here now, and I consider it my home. Labour Behind the Label is based in Bristol. We're a garment workers' rights campaign. We stand up for the human rights for garment workers around the world, which includes things like living wages, decent working conditions. We stand against forced labour and child labour and a number of other things. So we're working with companies who supply clothing to the high street and to sportswear brands, and trying to get them to improve their the way in which they buy and the way in which the places in which they source and get rights to workers.
Now, you obviously feel passionately about the subject. What got you interested in it in the first place?
I don't know. I've just always been interested in how I know how to buy the right clothes, and it's a really difficult minefield really for consumers as to where to go. But I was travelling also in India back a few years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, and I had the privilege to go travelling with this with an Indian gentleman who was buying for. He was selling actually some crochet that he was making with a big group of women somewhere in near Tirupur, and he was making this crochet product and trying to sell it. And then I was in a meeting with a factory owner and this seller, and they were discussing an order they were doing for IKEA, and it was this cushion cover. And IKEA had come back to them, they were halfway through an order, and they'd come back to them and said, we're going to cut the price of what we're going to pay for this item, and it's going to be cut by about, I don't know, it was about 20% or something. And it basically meant that whole of their profit margin had gone. But they said, no, we're going to keep producing this because we don't want to lose the business, because it's really important that next time we get another order with them. And it made me realise the whole cycle of how it works, really, that that big companies have a big power overseas that they push down on these smaller suppliers, which then in turn gets like shoved down the system, where the worker at the bottom, the woman who's doing the sewing, gets paid less and less and less. And
sounds a little bit like the supermarkets, the power that they have, but because they're doing all the distribution of the product to the to the public, they're actually doing the retail job. They can actually have got a lot of power when it comes to negotiating prices with the people who are actually producing the stuff.
Yeah, it's true.
Okay, tell us a bit about the fashion industry then. Is it, because I've heard that there's actually a very tiny number of people that really control the fashion industry. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. For example, companies on our high street, Arcadia Group own Topshop, and they own Miss Selfridge and Burton and Topman and Debenhams, and who else is in the Arcadia Group? I don't know, but they own a huge proportion of stores, and so that's Sir Philip Green, who actually is then and he owns this whole big independent company that really controls a lot of the UK high street.
But that sounds a bit naughty, really. It's like it's the same company, but they're trading under all sorts of different names on high streets right across Britain and across Europe and other parts of the world.
Yeah, that's true. And then, but then also, like the big buyers are now becoming the supermarkets too, because supermarket clothing is so cheap, and they're gaining big parts of the market share too. And Primark obviously is also on the rise, and they're now like almost monopolising the cheap clothing line as well.
So. Well, that's great for the consumer, though, isn't it?
Well, it is good for the consumer, yes. But it's bad for the worker.
So we're going back really to what you were first saying, which is, look, you know, I actually have a kind of a little pang of guilt about the work, you know, my the way I have to buy into the fashion industry, and that's why you're doing something about it. Well, that's great. Yeah. Martin Summers is here too. He's our old Labour economics expert and sort of political pundit character. Anyway, Martin, since Gordon Brown, by way of introduction, another little question for you. Since Gordon Brown bailed out the banks, did the banks owe the public money and the government money, or do we owe the banks money?
Well, I mean, we've given the money to the banks. Whether we've got any control for the money we've given them is another issue. On the banking issue, you'll see that this week the Icelandic government passed a bill to take over the bank, the Icelandic bank's debts, but the president of Iceland, Mr. Grimson, refused to sign it into law and is going to have a referendum on whether the Icelandic public should take the responsibility for the collapse of their private banks. And Gordon Brown and others have been waving the big stick and telling them if they don't toe the line, they'll get into all sorts of trouble. But Iceland looks as if it's going to repudiate those debts.
So is that something you think is very sensible for the Icelandic president to do? And for
I was reading about this, in actual fact, that Iceland's banks were publicly owned until 2003. So they'd built up one of the most successful societies on earth with the highest GNP per capita, very egalitarian income distribution, very high quality of life. And you know what? There wasn't a private bank in sight until 2003. And then people from the City of London came to them and said, oh, you don't want to have all that public banking. No, you need to modernise. You need private banks like us. So they privatised them. And now, apparently, they owe billions of euros, but they're not going to pay.
Well, that sounds pretty bad. But anyway, going back to this original question, do the banks owe the government money, or does the government owe the banks money?
The banks, in theory, owe the government money, but they're not going to pay it back because they're bust and they can't pay it back. So we're actually chucking money down a black hole as things stand. They need to be basically liquidated in an orderly fashion and their debts written off. But of course, that means that some people are going to lose an awful lot of money and they're not happy about that.
OK, well, moving on to our first story, and this is to do with the so-called leg bomber. This is over Christmas, of course. We've all heard about the chap apparently from Yemen, who obviously was in Britain too. But the story relating to that we're going to look at now is this whole thing of the Yemeni embassy being closed. Britain and the US are keeping the Yemeni embassy closed amid concern over militant attacks. And there's been quite a series stepping up, hasn't there, of the whole sort of rhetoric against Yemen. Martin, can you just start on this? Because I don't think that this may be the first time that many people have heard Yemen coming into on the radar as regards the war on terror, but it's actually been sort of fermenting down there for a while, hasn't it?
Yes, I mean, Yemen has been on the sort of hit list for you know, the war on terror for some time. What was interesting this week was that Gordon Brown said that he'd been talking to the Americans and to Obama and that they were going to take steps to support the government of Yemen in their struggle against Al-Qaeda, blah, 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 after the incident on Christmas Eve. But it transpires that in actual fact they've been working with the government of Yemen for months, and that it wasn't a new initiative at all. And so the supposed bomber has simply confirmed an existing policy of engagement with the regime in Sana'a, which is a rather unsavoury regime, not necessarily. I mean, in fact, possibly could be classed as a terrorist regime. Apparently, Saddam Hussein's ex-Baathist Mukhabarat are working with the regime and the Americans to deal with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, whatever that is. There's an ongoing escalation in the war on terror in Yemen, in Somalia, in Afghanistan. I'm afraid the US administration doesn't seem to be changing course at all.
But the idea of closing US and British embassies, is that actually a severing of diplomatic relations?
Well, they're not severing diplomatic relations with the government. They've closed the embassies because they say they fear to be attacked. But of course, what they're really doing is sending a signal that Yemen is not a safe place, and something will have to be done about it. And something is being done about it. I mean, US and British special forces are already in there. Apparently, the Americans have been carrying out bombing raids in Yemen, which they admitted to after the Nigerian bomber was apprehended. They said, "Oh, in actual fact, we have been bombing Yemen since December the 17th, but we didn't bother to tell you before."
Well, could be that this is some sort of retaliation for that cruise missile attacks and things that were going on previous to Christmas.
I think more likely, as you'll see, there's another story that you've got here, that passengers on the flight claim that he got onto the flight without a passport and didn't actually go through any kind of checks at all. These things need to be looked into properly by an independent police investigation. People shouldn't be jumping to conclusions about what the hell's going on here.
Anyway, Anna, you've obviously seen some of the coverage of this over the Christmas period. What do you think, what are your thoughts about the sort of whole war on terror project? And maybe you could also comment on Yemen specifically and this particular guy.
Well, I guess what I feel about the War on Terror project is it's a power mechanism. Obviously, it pops up every now and again through, you know, all the way through this ongoing thread through the news about the way in which people are using it as an excuse, or the governments are using it as an excuse just to keep attacking whoever they want to attack and placing people on flights. And it seems that this story here about a man getting on without a passport seems like a plant, doesn't it, obviously, that he was put on it. But
it sounds a bit strange. This is all apparently going on at Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport, and it's been told to the New York Daily News on Sunday. This is literally, you know, Boxing Day, just day after Boxing Day. A Michigan couple on the Detroit-bound flight that was almost blown up on Christmas Day say they saw the Nigerian terror suspect trying to board without a passport. They then say that they saw a sharply dressed Indian man in his 50s who did not get on the flight trying to talk an Amsterdam gate agent into letting the suspect board the Northwest Airlines flight without his passport. Now, this is unbelievable. This is about the lowest level of security you could possibly imagine. I think you need a passport to go almost anywhere. Mm. I mean, even sometimes within... I'm not sure if you need one to get to the Channel Islands. I'm not sure about that. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I'm not sure. But anyway... If the guy hasn't got a passport, what on earth is he doing getting on the plane?
Be careful about this. This is a New York Daily News article, and these people are eyewitnesses, and they say that they saw two people trying to get on the plane, one of them without a passport, and so on. Now, this could be true, it might not be true, but it's certainly something that people ought to be considering, rather than just presuming that they know what's happened here. Oh, yes, it's another one of those Al-Qaeda people trying to blow up an aeroplane. This is why we have police forces, is to investigate these things.
So I wonder
if the FBI have been saying to Kurt Haskell, who is this lawyer who's made these allegations, he said, I've approached the FBI and said, well, we can clear this up. Why don't you show me the videotape of the guy at the gate and I'll pick him out for you? But they've refused, and they won't. They've told him to shut up and go away.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's interesting.
Well, the FBI doesn't sound like the FBI doing their job very well either. I mean,
well, it depends what their job is, doesn't it?
It does make you wonder about these private security companies at the airports, how they can imagine that they can allow someone like this through without a passport, if this is true. Because, of course, they stand to gain tremendously from the war on terror, these private security companies.
Yes, well, they're part of the disaster capitalism complex, as identified by Naomi Klein, aren't they? I mean, they are, you know, the more disaster there is, the more money there is to be made in security and so forth.
Okay, Anna, any more to say on this?
No.
Okay, all right, well, let's go on to the next story, and this is about Blackwater now. Again, another security story. We had quite a lot over Christmas, as this is our first programme after the break. Blackwater employees apparently now are not welcome in Iraq, and this is following a Thursday, that was actually January the 3rd, ruling by a US judge to drop all charges against five Blackwater contractors. Now, this is a US-based private military company, and this is all over a 2007 Baghdad massacre. The Iraqi government is looking at what moves to take in retaliation. So it looks like the Iraqi government is now picking up the baton from the US Department of Justice, who was chasing these guys. If you hadn't heard about it, I think it was 17 people were killed by these Blackwater employees a couple of years ago, in 2007. Who are Blackwater, Martin? Can you just give us an idea of who this company are?
Well, they don't call themselves Blackwater anymore because of the bad publicity that the name is associated with this particular massacre. So I believe they're called XE or SHE, I don't know how you pronounce it. So they've rebranded themselves, but they're still operating. I mean, the US government is able to say that it's only got X number of troops in Iraq and X number of troops in Afghanistan because there are more mercenary contractors than public sector soldiers in both countries. And of course, they're not under any kind of supervision or control. They can behave in all sorts of nefarious ways. In Afghanistan last week, American paramilitaries, possibly Blackwater, captured a number of teenage boys, handcuffed them, and then executed them, which has caused absolute outrage inside Afghanistan. There have been demonstrations in the universities. Karzai has demanded an investigation. It's a huge, huge story in Afghanistan, but we've heard nothing. Nothing at all in the British media about it.
Anna, what are your thoughts about these private security companies? Because I imagine some of the... it may even be that as part of your work with the fashion industry, you come across security people sometimes, obviously not quite armed to the teeth like these guys are in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We don't really come across security people who
That's
sell
good. At least, thank goodness for that. But I mean, just on the principle of the idea of private companies now sort of taking over the role, because this is what we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, isn't it? A slow swapping of the official military forces for these private companies, basically, with a lot of them are ex military personnel. Just if you just give us your thoughts on this whole trend.
I guess what worries me about that is just that it's more and more going out of control, and that they don't have the obligation to report back, or they're not going to have the obligation to do things in the way in which a government department might, or that as things are farmed out, like, which is what we see in the fashion industry, is it further and further as it goes down through contracts and contracts, people have less responsibility for anything and so feel free just to do whatever they like. So security companies, I imagine the same sort of thing would happen, in that it's less safety for the people.
Well, one of my problems is the whole sort of perception issue, which is we hear all this massive announcement about the military withdrawing from Iraq, and actually what's going on is they're just being replaced by contractors.
Yeah.
Anyway, Martin, what about you? Any last thoughts on Blackwater and the whole sort of PMC, private military contractor business?
Well, I'd call me old-fashioned, but I think if you train somebody to kill people, it shouldn't be something that's for sale on the market. You know, I'm not a pacifist. Sometimes violence may sometimes be regrettably necessary, but it should always be carried out by state officials with proper lines of accountability, and it certainly shouldn't be done for private profit, because, of course, then you get an interest in having wars for private profit, and that's, I'm afraid, where we've got to.
Okay, moving on to a slightly more fashion industry friendly story, and one that Anna's brought along. Intelligence agencies, and this is in the New Nation, I think this is today actually, the New Nation, intelligence agencies are fearing a massive unrest because of pressure for wage refixation of RMG workers. All right, first of all, what's wage refixation and who are RMG?
Ready-made garment workers, so those are going to be people who will be producing for the UK High Street, or for high streets around. I guess wage fixation, that's to do with actually setting a wage level, a new minimum wage level, so that garment workers are being paid above a certain rate. That happened once in 2001, I think it was, in Bangladesh. They set a wage at, it's about like a 1,500 taka or something like that, and it's that's maybe about an eighth or a ninth of what is necessary to live as a living wage.
But any idea what the equivalent is in British money? It's well below our minimum wage.
It's well below our minimum wage. It's about, maybe that's about 40 pence an hour.
40 pence an hour. Okay.
That's in kind of buying capacity. I'm imagining it as if that would be. Yeah, a percentage
so
of
how many countries?
Wages.
How many countries that are sort of Malaysia and Bangladesh and these have actually got minimum wages? Because that's a pretty
most
important.
Most have a minimum wage. Most have a minimum wage, but what's but those minimum wages are well below what is necessary for actual proper standard of living. Countries set minimum wages very low in order to encourage export, because they're all fighting against each other to try and get all this production come to their area. So minimum wages, especially in Bangladesh, are set very, very, very low. So this story is about lots of unions saying that they're going to strike, or they're calling strongly on the government to reassess the need to fix the wages.
So the government's brought in the military intelligence people in order to try and control the situation, or maybe to put down the strikes or whatever.
Yeah, they're looking into what unions are doing and the unrest that's rising again. And there's in Bangladesh, there's a history really of unrest and of lots of union strikes and
is it just strikes, or are there other tactics that the garment workers can use in order to try and get a decent wage?
Well, often there's violence, actually. You get quite a lot of there was just a few months ago there was a bombing, or there were some people actually attacking a factory or trying to set it alight with fire bombs and stuff.
Cool.
It was some people got killed. And
so it's just as an ordinary shopper. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a great fashion shopper, but is there anything you can look out for when you're actually buying clothes, maybe to do with labelling or actually where you buy them from, that you can make some assessment about maybe whether these have been ethically put together or not, or whether someone is working in a sweatshop, maybe child labour, that sort of thing?
The common misconception is that if you buy some clothes that have a fair trade mark on it, that means that the person who sewed it was paid a fair wage. That's not correct. When it's got a fair trade mark on it, it means that it's the cotton was, or the farmer who grew the cotton was paid a fair wage. It doesn't certify anything to do with production. There isn't yet a mark which certifies production, because that's just a desperately difficult thing to do, in that it's produced in 8 or 9 factories in different parts of the world and passed around, and that you can't, it's really difficult to certify a huge production chain. But that's something that is coming, and quite a lot of the Fair Trade Foundation want to certify that, but we're a bit scared that that's going to happen, that with not the proper levels of rigour in order to be able to make sure that those people are actually being paid more than minimum wage.
So is it just potluck then? You may get something that's been made in an ethical fashion, and you may buy something which is made really unethically. I suppose one of the indications might be the price. If it's really cheap, then it's probably been made in an unethical way.
That's not necessarily the case, actually. For example, we had a big case with Primark at the end of last year. Sorry, not Primark, with Prada at the end of last year. And Prada, who make very expensive clothes, but yet it was a case where they'd sacked all of their union, all the union leaders, and I think the factory had closed without paying the workers. So, I mean, these sorts of things happen in many different supply chains, and I think the problem is that the industry as a whole is really the workers are not being paid what they ought to be across the board, and so wherever whichever brand that you're using, a lot of them share these factories, and
But isn't this just a sort of natural spin-off from globalisation? Because what we're doing is we're now sourcing stuff from all over the world. I mean, obviously we were before as well, but that's even more, that's happening even more now. And we just have to literally lump it, because we can't tell these countries how to run their affairs, how to set their minimum wage, etc.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, you're right.
So, what can you do as campaigners then to try and make sure that the stuff we're buying is both fashionable and and ethical?
Well, we're pushing it on a lot of different levels, I guess. So we're lobbying with high street companies to ask, to demand that they're the ones who are bringing about the change.
So, are they taking any notice?
To a certain extent, we publish every year something called the Let's Clean Up Fashion Report, where we profile a lot of these, 25 of the big top high street companies about what they're doing for workers, and there's quite a lot of media attention around that, and then they all get like quite scared, and they start sending us emails going, oh, is my profile okay, how's it going, and then they suck up to us for about a month, and then they ignore us for the rest of the year. But it's an interesting process, in that they we're trying to report on how they're actually doing in their factories, and they tell us about what the living wages, or how they're getting living wages to workers, and how they monitor their factories by sending in people to look at actually what's happening, and then and how they're working to kind of amend all the problems. But the problem is that a lot of them don't actually know where all of their sourcing is really happening, because a lot of them buy through something called a buying house, where they'll give the money to the person and say, hey, can you source this for us? And then they'll go out and they'll source in a first-tier factory and a second-tier factory and a third-tier factory. And as it goes further and further down the chain, people are being paid less and less. So
is there also a problem with child labour, or is it mainly just to do with low wages for those, adults?
Child labour still exists in a lot of places, but it's becoming less. There was a big boom about it in the 90s, and I think the industry wised up to it, and it's in most codes of conduct in pretty much all factories that there is no child labour. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen now, we don't think, in many first-tier factories, but like second-tier factories, third-tier factories, getting more likely, and home workers, probably that still does happen, yes.
Right, Martin, you're a bit of a fashion guru, everyone knows. When you go down to buy your shirt or whatever, do you actually think about this? And do you think it's a serious issue that we should try and get ahead of?
It is
around?
A serious issue, but I think we might be misleading ourselves by imagining that we're going to solve things just through ethical consumerism.
No.
Consumerism, however ethical, is not necessarily going to resolve all of these issues. The issues in Bangladesh about people going on strike to defend their living standards, there needs to be general rules and regulations about this so that people do have their right to defend their labour protected, so that if they do go on strike, they're not brutalised, they're not attacked, their leaders are not intimidated, and so on and so forth. And this is basic human rights. This is what people should have wherever they are. They should have the basic rights to defend their labour through joining free trade unions. Mm. And that is fundamental. And, of course, people have got to fight their own battles. We can't fight them for them. They have to fight their own battles. But we should support them when they do fight those battles.
Yeah.
And we should try to do everything we can to make sure that they win them.
Mm. Mm. Well, this is another thing that Labour Behind the Label does. We also do quite a lot of overseas casework, in that if there's an issue within a factory, and there's been some workers who've had an issue in that the union leaders have been fired or they haven't been paid correctly, then we can take up that case with the company and try and lobby them to sort it out, which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. We have to go public about it and start telling newspapers, but yeah.
Okay, on to our next story, and this is to do with the Gaza aid convoy. And we're going to have a little listen now to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, where just after David Cameron asked his first question, there was actually a question asked to Gordon Brown about the whole situation in Gaza and in Palestine.
A year on from the devastating conflict in Gaza, which left 1,400 Palestinians dead, the siege continues. Humanitarian relief is hard to come by and Gaza lies shattered. Although there were undoubtedly war crimes on both sides, does my right honourable friend agree with me that what is now happening is the collective punishment of a million people? And will he now make urgent representations to ease the siege on Gaza as a critical step towards a peace settlement? Yeah.
My friend is absolutely right, and she speaks for many people on this. We must not forget the people of Gaza. I have raised with Prime Minister Netanyahu the speed at which aid and humanitarian assistance can get into Gaza. We are pressing the Israeli government to do more that they can to get more aid in, and I will look at exactly the points that she has made and see what more we can do in this new year. In the end, this will require a political settlement between Israel and the Palestinian state, which gives Israel security and Palestine a viable economic state that it can manage. But in the meantime, we must avoid unnecessary suffering.
Well, we've heard on the news today, as we speak, George Galloway has been forcibly put on a plane in Egypt and is on his way back to Britain. I imagine when he lands, he'll be having a few things to say about all this at the airport. It's not really fair to say it's George Galloway's convoy, is it, Martin?
No, I mean, he's obviously played a leading role in putting the whole thing together. Of course, he's got a media profile, which he uses to press the cause.
And the nice thing is we've got quite a few people from Bristol, Gloucester, yes, and around this part of the country.
Well,
I
went along to the send-off for the Bristol lorry that's part of this convoy, and we had good wishes for the Bristol lorry from all the political leadership in the city, including the Richard Eddy from the Conservatives, which was very welcome. And I think there's a general consensus in Britain and in Bristol that the situation is not acceptable in Gaza.
Anna, what's your thoughts on the whole Gaza thing?
Don't know what there is to say, really. It's obviously an issue which we need to kind of take responsibility for and start, like, doing more about.
But what can we do from all the way over here? It's really, surely, nothing to do with us. This is between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
No, that's not the case.
Israel is in receipt of huge amounts of subsidy from the US taxpayer. Yeah. We are major allies of the US. Tony Blair is supposedly a peace envoy, which makes me laugh, and supposedly bringing peace to the Middle East. I mean, Britain, of course, was the occupying power in Palestine and gave the go-ahead for the setting up of the State of Israel in 1917 and in 1948. So we can hardly opt out of the responsibility for the situation.
Well, there was some of the campaigners here in Bristol, particularly part of the Bristol Gaza Link, were very unhappy that the local BBC Points West refused to cover their demonstration they held outside the BBC earlier this week. Anyway, on Wednesday, I went down there and had a chat to some of the Bristol Gaza Link campaigners and other Palestine Solidarity people who were there to raise the issue of why the local television weren't covering any of the people here in from Bristol who were actually part of that convoy after it had been attacked.
Together with myself and other leaders of the convoy.
Sorry, this is George Galloway first.
With the Egyptian authorities about their determination to remove more than 55 of our vehicles and send them to the Israeli checkpoint. But we refuse this because it's a breach of the agreement that we reached in Aqaba between the government of Egypt and the Turkish side. And it is completely unconscionable that 25% of our convoy should go to Israel and never arrive in Gaza, because nothing that goes to Israel ever arrives in Gaza.
Yeah, that was George Galloway there. Now we go back to Wednesday, where I was outside the BBC, and we were told also by the BBC that the reason that Points West didn't cover this was because they saw the issue was too sensitive.
I'm Dan Isles, and I'm a member of Bristol University, Bristol Left, which is a student left-wing group set up last year. And I'm here to represent the members of the convoy, the Bristol members and the British and international members of the convoy who have been held up in Egypt, attacked by riot police, and not allowed to deliver their humanitarian aid towards Gaza.
My name's Caroline, and I am here because the convoy has been stopped going into Gaza, and there's been no report of this from the BBC, and I just wanted to know why, because it was last year's bombardment by Israel hit everybody in the world, you know, and know what was going on. Yeah. Well, I think the BBC ought to take more interest in what's going on in the world. They turn a blind eye to many things which they don't want to recognise, you know. Like, if Israel has killed 1,400 people, they kind of say this is because of the Gazans firing rockets, or because of some suicide bombers. There haven't been any of those for a few years now, but nonetheless they are brought up every time.
I mean, you know some of the people that are on the convoy. Yes, how determined are they?
How determined? I think they are very determined. A Bristol student is in hospital, having been hit on the head by Egyptian police. So, that was showing some determination, that he was able to risk, you know, being injured by the police.
My name's Brian. I'm here because I've got a friend of mine on the convoy who's gone with from Gloucester. And he's been sending us regular texts. The last few texts we've got from him have been in Al Arish, where the convoy appears to have been detained in the compound by the Egyptian security forces. There's been some sort of fighting going on last night. Five or six people were arrested and a couple of people hospitalised. And there seems like the latest couple of texts I've received, that's this morning, so that's Wednesday morning, have been that there's an agreement between the convoy leadership and the Egyptians to release the people that have been arrested, and that some of the convoy vehicles, about 60 of them, will be going through Israel and therefore will not get to Gaza. And then I had a text after that saying those vehicles are now going to be given to the Syrian or Jordanian governments, and the aid will be distributed to people in Jordan or Syria.
Now, everything was going quite well with the convoy until it got to Egypt. Why do you think it's it's hit so many problems? And I also believe that it's been split up into two as well.
That's what the Egyptians were trying to do, was split the convoy up. Obviously, they didn't want them to turn up in a sort of triumphant convoy. That was it, because the Egyptian government do not want them there at all.
Why is it then that the Egyptians, I mean, this is obviously an Arab country, why is it the Egyptians seem to be so hostile and actually stopping the free passage of what is effectively humanitarian aid?
Because the Egyptian government do not support Hamas. and do not want to have a strong Islamic style.
So you're saying it's basically a Western-style government in Egypt is one of the reasons.
Well, it is a Western-style government, otherwise it wouldn't be there. It's there with the support of the Americans.
Okay. Why is it you think this is such an important issue? I mean, this is a cold, snowy day, and you stood outside the BBC here. Why is this something important?
I didn't initially think it was that important, and I'm still not sure if that sending humanitarian aid over there is the be-all and end-all, but it's raising consciousness, making people realise what's going on, and basically you can't treat people as the Israelis are treating the Palestinians. It's going back to that's how the Jews were treated by the Nazis. Now the Jewish state is doing it to the Palestinians, and it's not on. You can't have it. And I think as far as English people are concerned, it's being done in their name with their money. So that's why it's important.
I'm Barbara Smith, and I'm a member of Bristol Gaza Link, and so I'm supporting the convoy that's going to Gaza. Well, we're just, it's, you know, because they've been refused to get into Gaza City, and there's now quite a lot of violence. It's a peaceful humanitarian mission, and we are concerned about the people in Palestine, especially the children that are suffering. There's a lot of suffering going on, and they need medical aid. That's the main reason why they're going. It's a peaceful humanitarian mission.
That was recorded on Wednesday outside the BBC at a demonstration by the Bristol Palestine Solidarity Group. So, as I said just before that, apparently Dawn Trevitt, who is the output editor at BBC Points West, said that they didn't want to cover the fact that many of the Bristol people were caught up in this tangle and violence and arrests in Egypt because it was too sensitive. Anyway, Martin, just leaving this issue of BBC censorship aside, can you give us a little update on what you know has been happening with the convoy since Wednesday? Because I think they've actually managed to get the aid in now, haven't they?
I believe that some aid has gone in. They were going to drive in through Egypt, then they had to go back to Syria and get on ships to come in to go round the coast. I mean, the whole thing strikes me as very extraordinary. If I were the Egyptians or the Israelis, I would have ignored this convoy and just let it drive in. By blocking and obstructing in the way that they have done, they've drawn attention to the continued siege of Gaza. And I think, you know, the outside world has done its bit here. We have turned up, or not us, but people from Bristol have turned up, and people from all other parts of the world have turned up on the anniversary of the unprovoked assault on Gaza. Well, you say it's unprovoked because of the missiles and so on, but I mean, it was totally one-sided, really. The world, I hope the Palestinians realise that the world hasn't forgotten them and that somebody does care.
I don't think it's fair entirely to say it is one-sided, is it? Because there were these little rockets, Katusha rockets, sure, isn't it, that were being fired out into Israel.
Sure, I mean but don't forget, there have been ceasefires. There's a ceasefire at the moment. And, of course, ceasefires are the steps towards peace. I mean, that was the case in Northern Ireland, it was the case in South Africa. Hamas have been able to deliver ceasefires, but it's just that nobody seems to be interested.
So why is it, do you think, that the Israelis and the Egyptians have been so against this humanitarian aid convoy?
Well, as one of your contributors just pointed out, they don't want a triumphant convoy arriving in Gaza, raising their morale, making them look silly, and so on and so forth.
So this is about morale, hearts and minds, do you think?
Yes, maybe? I mean, don't forget, we've had all this fuss about whether Iran did or did not have a democratic election. Well, they have democratic elections in Egypt where the president gets 98% of the vote, but because he's our friend, we don't ask questions. And of course, Hamas is allied with the Muslim Brotherhood, which are the main opposition force in Egyptian politics and would probably be the government if there was a democracy in Egypt, which of course we have no intention of allowing.
Anna, can you just ask you to comment finally on this issue of humanitarian aid? Because it does seem a bit strange to me that medical supplies and other forms of humanitarian aid being taken in, it does seem a bit strange that it should be stopped by these governments, the Egyptians and the Israelis particularly.
I guess, it's all about power structures and who's going to let who do what, and that you can use anything like a convoy in order to be able to barter for certain gains and losses. So, makes sense that it's been stopped, but hopefully it'll get through in the end.
Well, I think it has. I think so. I was having a look on the internet at lunchtime today, and almost all of the vehicles have now been let through. And so I imagine over the next week or so, most of the people who haven't been arrested will be returning to Bristol and Gloucester.
Can I just pick up on what Jordan Brown said earlier on, which is that there needs to be a political solution to this whole business, and not just sticking plasters and humanitarian convoys. And that political solution requires talking to Hamas, who did in fact win the election in Palestine. The Western and Israeli policy is to ignore them, even though they won the election, and that is the root of a lot of the problems here. If they won the election, they are the government and they are the people that should be dealing with.
Okay, now we're going to move on to another story now, and this is just yesterday morning it was announced that the local bus operators will be facing a competition probe. This is the Office of Fair Trading, which has referred providers of local bus services to the Competition Commission after uncovering evidence a distorted market is leading to higher prices and poorer service quality. Well, what they don't mention there, of course, is nice bonuses for shareholders. Anna, are you someone that uses the bus a lot?
I'm not someone who uses the bus a lot, but I'd like to use the bus a lot, but because first of so flipping expensive and so late quite a lot of the time, I don't use it. I think this is long overdue. I think that's a great idea.
Well, it's a shame because one of the last inquiries along these lines was the one into banking, wasn't it? And whether or not the high street banks should be allowed to charge anything for overdraft payments, or whether it should actually be related to the amount that they, and that was completely stopped by the courts. So let's hope that this is a little bit more successful. Mm-hmm. Anna, what did you think of their decision, First Bus's decision, to pull out the bus service when the snow started? Because, I mean, they're mainly back going now, but there seemed to be a whole day when there were virtually no buses in the entire city, even though most of the main roads were clear.
Yeah, I think probably that was a financial decision, in that quite a lot of I imagine a lot of their staff didn't come in, and then they decided just to cut it. But it was probably quite awful for a lot of old people, for example, who may have needed to get lots of places, or
It's part of the essential infrastructure of the city, really, isn't it? That you would have thought that it should be moving. Where, I mean, I was Tuesday. I was walking around in the city centre, and I could see there was just, you know, it was perfectly okay to move around. You could use the roads fine, but there were just no buses. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts on the probe into local competition?
We're still stuck in free market land, aren't we? Where the idea that more competition will somehow bring down the prices. The reason why buses were nationalised, or rather owned by local authorities, for example, in the 40s and subsequently, was because it's natural that there should be a monopoly in a local geographical area. Mm. Yes, so that you can have, for example, a timetable that makes sense and buses that connect to each other. And so something like local transport infrastructure naturally tends towards monopoly, and that is why it should be in the public sector and run for public benefit and not for private profit. The attempt to try and bring competition into this situation will not work, because competition leads to consolidation, which leads to one big player in most major cities. It's inevitable. And of course, we've had a Labour government since 1997 that has pussyfooted around on transport policy. I mean, the fact is that the buses should never have been privatised in the first place.
Hang on a minute, because I can remember living in Oxford in the 1990s, there were two bus companies there in Oxford, and my goodness, they really were competing with each other.
Yes, they were, until one of them won, and then that's what happens. You have cutthroat competition until one of them wins, and then you've got a monopoly, and that's what always happens.
And they've managed to maintain it in Manchester. In Manchester, there's about three or four bus companies, I think, that are still in competition and managing it. But I think actually those. I think it's subsidised by local authority, yes, in that they're trying.
That's the other thing. A lot of the most useful routes, you know, the ones that run out of Bristol, for example, out to the Styx, have to be subsidised anyway. Mm. So why is a private company making profit on something that we're subsidising? If we're subsidising it, we might as well just subsidise it.
One of the other problems with competition with buses, which we would sometimes wryly smile at in Oxford, was the way that the buses would sort of try and overtake the other bus down the road so they could get to the bus stop first.
I lived in Oxford at that time, and of course, at one stage there were buses piled up down the Iffley Road and down the Cowley Road touting for customers, and the traffic couldn't move because there were too many buses. But of course what happened pretty damn quick is that one big operator, whether it was First Bus or Stagecoach or whatever, took over and became the monopoly. And of course, what, you know, then the market settles down, and they carve it up between them, and they carve up the profits between them. And of course the consumer and the passenger become way down the list of priorities. These local infrastructures need to be under public control and run for public benefit.
I'll be interested to see what comes out of this probe. I imagine they'll do the probe and then they'll say, oh, well, what we need is more competition. And then how are they actually really going to implement that? What are they really going to do? And I think, you know, if the end of the report is that there are options that this should become you know, public, or whether we should just kind of encourage more private ownership, then yeah.
It'd be quite difficult to renationalise the buses, wouldn't it?
Not necessarily. Quite straightforward. You just create.
Here's our resident chancellor.
If local authorities had the power, they could just set up their own company. They would easily outcompete the private sector because they could subsidise. It could be much cheaper. You could just drive them out of business virtually overnight. No problem. That's what happened in the 40s.
I think we did have something called the Bristol Omnibus Company, didn't we, for a long time here, which was running all the bus services up until privatisation, which was, you know, pretty successful.
Well, if you remember Ken Livingstone when he was Mayor of London the first time in the early 80s, he had the fares fair policy, and the idea was to try and drive the buses down to being very, very cheap so that people would use them instead of getting in their cars. In some Italian cities, you have absolutely free buses. Yeah, people just hop on and off them. That's a thought, isn't it? You could have just free buses running up and down and people just jump on and off them.
Well, one of the spin-offs from the Fares Fair in London, because I was living there at the time in the 80s, was that there was a dramatic drop in the number of accidents because there were far less cars on the road and people just decided, well, let's use the bus because it's so cheap.
The public transport infrastructure in London used to be so good that when people travel to London, they would leave their cars on the outskirts and just use the public transport infrastructure. That's no longer the case. And we've this privatisation ideology has done such damage to basic infrastructure in this country. And we've had a Labour government since 1997, and they've done nothing to reverse any of it. They've just accepted it all. And this competition, a competition probe, will find out what we know already, that local monopoly is the norm in public transport. That's why it should be publicly owned.
So do you think there are certain things that should never be privatised and certain industries? Because
we were talking about military companies earlier. I don't think that there should be private companies selling death and destruction. That should be absolutely public monopoly.
That sounds, I suppose you could put it like that. But, okay, so the local... Do you actually yourself use the buses, Martin, at all?
Well, I do now because my car's been stolen. So, although I do actually walk, although it's quite dangerous walking around at the moment.
It's probably safer to get on a bus than it is to try and negotiate those icy pavements out there.
It's hanging around waiting for buses, which is so demoralising, especially for old folk in this weather, isn't it?
Mm.
Okay, so let's move on to our next to last story, which is to do with MI5 still using threats to recruit Muslim spies. This was by Robert Verkolk in the Independent a couple of days ago. Security services say apparently using blackmail to turn us into informers, say immigrants. MI5 faces accusations that its officers have blackmailed and harassed vulnerable immigrants living in Britain as part of a campaign to recruit spies to report on Muslim communities. Which one would you like to stop? Martin, you can start, because you sent me this one on email.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we look at the methods that are being used to recruit informers, you know, pressure tactics of this kind, we know that the Nigerian underpants bomber was apparently recruited to Al-Qaeda when he was in Yemen, or possibly when he was at the University of London. And the question has to be asked, who is Al-Qaeda and who is recruiting who to what? We know that groups like Al-Majahurun, for example, which are often demonised in the media, have very strong links to the British intelligence services. They were used to recruit young boys to fight in Afghanistan in the 80s and in Kosovo and Bosnia in the 90s. So many of these Muslim extremist groups based in Britain, in what Melanie Phillips calls Londonistan, because we've got lots of extremist Muslim groups based in London, and that is because London was the base for the Islamic Jihad in Afghanistan in the 80s. MI6 were the lead agency in that jihad. They recruited people from all over the world, and the headquarters for all of this was London. And it's because London, because that's where MI6 are based. Now, we have to ask ourselves the question, what are the linkages? What were the linkages? What still are the linkages, possibly, between MI6, MI5, CIA, and so-called Al-Qaeda? I understand that we're going to be talking about Robin Cook later. When he was Foreign Secretary, he said, as far as I'm aware, Al-Qaeda means the database, a database held in Amman, Jordan, set up by the CIA, and on that database is the list of all of the Islamic extremists from Algeria, from Morocco, from Jordan, from elsewhere, who were funneled into the Islamic International Brigades in Afghanistan in the 80s by the British intelligence and Western intelligence services. So virtually all of this Islamic Jihad has got its roots in Western intelligence service operations. That's a fact. That's not conspiracy theory. That's not even disputable.
But
the question
is,
are they still with their fingers in there?
Don't you think those who are involved in this fighting on the side of the Islamics or the Taliban in Afghanistan, for example, would be rather annoyed with you saying, well, this is all something that started in London?
No, you've got to distinguish between things like the Taliban, which are a kind of, you know, radical movement based in Afghanistan with goals related to Afghanistan, and Al-Qaeda, which is an international conspiracy which mostly seems to be based in Western cities like Hamburg and London, who go around just carrying out random acts of mayhem. That's completely different. I mean, groups like Hezbollah or Hamas, they're not manipulated, or not directly anyway. There's lots of suspicion out there in the real world beyond Britain and the US that a lot of this stuff is being orchestrated by Western intelligence services. And you can poo-poo if you like, but if you look at the Pakistani press, for example, the English language press in Pakistan, it's full of allegations of US manipulation of terrorist incidents inside Pakistan. And normal people in Pakistan, doctors, lawyers, teachers, they take all this absolutely seriously. And who's being silly here? Middle-class people in Britain who know nothing, or middle-class people in Pakistan who actually know what goes on?
Well, just to quote this article, Ishak Elmi, 31, says he was bombarded with more than 200 phone calls and tricked into attending meetings at police stations in Birmingham. In one of the most recent phone calls, Mr. Elmi says an MI5 officer calling himself Jahil threatened him by saying, one way or another, we're going to get you. Ahmed Dini, a Dutch citizen who settled in Britain, said he was visited by agents at the Birmingham school where he worked and threatened with arrest. When he went on holiday, he says he was twice detained at UK airports. He alleges he was also bombarded with phone calls and threatened with detention under the Terrorism Act. On three occasions, he claims, MI5 agents, a man called James and a female officer, suggested that his life would be made easier if he agreed to work for MI5. And one of the things he's saying is that if people want to recruit someone to do this, they should do it down at the job centre because he's already got a job. Anyway, Anna, what are your thoughts about the idea of MI5 running around trying to recruit people in this way? Have you got any thoughts on the subject? Because it just sounds a bit peculiar to me.
Well, what's to say? I think it's terrible that people should get should be accosted in their own homes or made to sign up to something. It worries me that we live in a state where this sort of thing happens, where people are being forced into having to report on their friends. It just sounds like some sort of Cold War mentality, doesn't it?
So it sounds like the sort of beginnings of a police state kind of thing, being recruited to just, threatened and then told that you've got to report on your friends.
Yeah.
Can I just say, it's not really a police state. A police state is a rule of law, where there are rules and regulations about what goes on. MI5 are operating outside the rule of law here. What I would advise people to do, if they have any suspicions about terrorism or terrorist offences, is to cooperate with the local police force, the civilian police force, which is accountable to the local community. Mm. And I would also say to any Muslim listening to this broadcast, have nothing whatsoever to do with the security services. They, goodness knows what they're up to. I suspect that they're part of the problem and not part of the solution. But we've got to actually have a rule of law enforced by the police, not by anybody else.
Okay, on to our last story now. And this is from the Tiruppur News, if that's the right pronunciation. Dyer's strike jeopardises Tiruppur garment orders. Manufacturers of knitted garments in India's knitwear city fear their orders from European and US retailers are in jeopardy as the region's dyers strike heads into its third week. Do you want to just comment on that one, Anna? before we come up to the news?
Well, yeah, there's been big strikes in the garment industry in Tirupur, which is a region which produces loads and loads of knitwear, which is the stretchy stuff which pretty much all T-shirts are made out of. It's a big sourcing area in India, and all of the factory owners and the suppliers are really worried at the moment in that if this dyer's strike continues, they're not going to be able to finish any of their orders, and they're going to lose business with the international industry. In that, what will happen is that all of those companies will relocate. They'll lose their contracts with the big buyers, and then those companies relocate to China or something where they'll be able to get it instantly. It's a story, I guess, about people really pushing their employers because it's going to mean thousands of pounds lost in business.
Okay, Anna, thanks ever so much for joining us today. It's nearly time now for the Sky News at 6. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, ex-Panorama correspondent and ITN Middle East and Foreign correspondent Alan Hart will be with us reviewing the news. Stay with us if you can, though, because credit crunch beater Billy Quain will be here after the 6 o'clock news with his guide to what's on for free and reasonably cheap around town this weekend. Also in the next hour, we take a look at the coming Ukrainian presidential election. The biggest country in Europe, will it choose the Western-backed or Russian-backed candidate? Also, looking back over the past decade, we review the untimely death of Robin Cook. That's in the second hour. Join us again after the news.
It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.